You're listening to the Seasteading Today podcast, where we speak to entrepreneurs and researchers who are making the dream of seasteading a reality. The Seasteading Today podcast. Stop arguing and start seasteading.
Hello, seasteaders. This is Carly Jackson on the Seasteading Today podcast. My guest today is Dr. Ricardo Radulovich, a professor at the University of Costa Rica, where he works on promoting aquatic food production. We talked about how cultivating seaweed can reverse some of the damage done to waterways caused by land-based agriculture. Here at the Seasteading Institute, we often get contacted by people who are worried that building seasteads will just expand the problems created on land into the ocean. Projects like Dr. Radulovich's seaweed farms show us how to grow food and create jobs while improving the health of the ocean. In this podcast, you'll learn that seaweed is a lot more than that slimy stuff that brushes against your leg at the beach. Enjoy the interview with Dr. Ricardo Radulovich. Hello, and welcome to the Seasteading Today podcast. My guest today is Dr. Ricardo Radulovich, who is working to feed the world by cultivating seaweed. Welcome, Dr. Radulovich.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So the Seasteading book talks about your Sea Gardens project and the Cultivated Seaweeds for Food project. Are those projects still active?
In a way, yes. We're doing that. We are cultivating seaweeds and we're advancing in their use as food. And there are many other uses as well. Yes, we continue doing that. And we are now beginning another project aiming at solving some limitations, for example, reproduction laboratories and stuff like that, to be able to do it at a larger scale.
That's wonderful. So tell us a bit about what are some of the problems that can be solved by cultivating seaweed?
Well, the basic idea is that agriculture on land may not be sufficient to provide all the needed increases in food, particularly not only because of increasing population and demand from this increasing population, but also due to, say, climate change and also on itself. Even without climate change, we were having a lot of problems with water limitations. So, of course, agriculture may provide sufficient food, but at what cost? So we need alternative sources of food, and I think that if the main limitation to food production on land is water and lack of good land for agriculture, then we have all the water we need and all the area we need to cultivate at sea. So that's the basic principle. We believe that a lot of biomass, plant biomass that can be produced for food, feed, and other uses can be produced at sea.
So as a landlocked person who has, you know, minimal information about what causes climate change, how does moving farming to sea, how do we not just transfer the same problems that we've created with land agriculture? Why don't those same problems transfer when we're cultivating seaweed?
That may happen. We may eventually end up having some problems similar in many ways or different than in agriculture. But so far, we have identified mostly benefits from growing seaweeds. There are some limitations. Of course, there are some diseases. There are problems also with water being heating up, ocean heating, that affects some of the established practices around the world. So we have to be aware of those limitations as well. But the beauty of cultivating seaweeds is that we don't need fertilizer, because at least up to a very high point, we can produce using the excess nutrients that are present in water. These excess nutrients come from land, from agricultural runoff, from sewage waters. So we're having, for example, all these algal blooms, even the sargasso problem in the Gulf of Mexico, Caribbean, is in very much related to excess nutrients in the waters. So we take advantage of that. And at the same time, then we clean the water, all those excess nutrients. So it is like a win-win situation.
Okay, so it sounds like, you know, land agriculture, a lot of the fertilizer and runoff from those land from land agriculture washes into the rivers and washes into the sea, and so cultivating seaweed on the coasts can take advantage of taking those that runoff and turning it into a useful product, which is algae and seaweed. Is that correct?
Correct. Also, at the same time, contributing to clean the water.
Okay, so I've read about red algae on the coast of Florida. So that's a bad kind of algae, or is it just that people are not in a position to use that algae?
No, we have no clue really how to use these microalgae blooms that, like those happening in Florida. Those are usually associated with some toxic elements that these microalgae produce. So they can have harmful effects beyond a lot of biomass in the water, you see, because you can have algal blooms that are not toxic, but the water gets so polluted with organic matter that then all the oxygen is used up by bacteria consuming the dead bodies of algae, and all the waters then become hypoxic, low in oxygen, even dead in many ways, they are called.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one problem. But then sometimes microalgae are also associated with some toxins they produce. So it is a compounded problem. We would be solving those problems in many ways because these blooms are associated with excess nutrients. Mm-hmm. So we need to manage those nutrients. And even only for that purpose, we could cultivate seaweeds just to clean up these excess nutrients.
So tell us about your seaweed farms that you are building. What do they look like and where are they located? And who is working these seaweed farms?
Well, we are working with fishers, men and women. They are the ones who we want to be farmers. Fishers in all around the world are suffering from dwindling fisheries. They're in need of additional sources of income. And to cultivate seaweed seems like a very viable option in many ways and also helps to preserve their way of life. They continue working at sea. It's just that they change from being only fishers to being fishers and farmers as well. We also work integrating seaweed with other forms of aquaculture, like fish farming or bivalve, like mussels and oysters, because this increases the opportunity to produce profit, and the interest of fishers is larger. It's maintained by having different products to sell that have good market entry.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it provides a diverse economy for these fish formerly. So these fishing communities have more diverse economy, and that can make their economy stronger. Are you seeing that?
Yes. To have this diversity is always a good way of being sure that you will have something or a lot. Depending on conditions, for example, you may have a low fishing season, but you have your seaweeds, you have your bivalves, your mussels, for example, that keep on growing, and you always have something to sell or eat, even in some cases. This approach is something that is analogous to some farming and in agriculture. You find many small farmers, traditional farmers, that they have all sort of different crops, trees, and animals as well.
Now, are these so? If you have a seaweed farm and you're also growing mussels and supporting some fishing or fish farms, is that something that needs to be on the coast, or could you move that out into the high seas for a seasteading community?
Yes, in many ways you can. The point is that usually these excess nutrients are in coastal waters. So you have to locate areas and in the high seas where you have at least some input of nutrients. This can be also part of a scheme of sustainable fertilization practices that you can implement at the high seas. So yes, you can do this. It doesn't matter. The production systems we have are floating. It doesn't matter how deep the bottom is.
So how does one start a seaweed farm? What does it look like? What infrastructure do you need to start?
Okay. Usually what you need is just moorings, attachment points where you have to be anchored to some place. You may have some free floating systems as well, but you have to be careful where you place them so you don't lose them, for example. And if you have, like, say, a seasteading, you may attach your seaweed cultivated areas to the more rigid, bigger structures of the seasteading. So you may not need specific moorings on the bottom. Then you need ropes. Usually this is made with a different arrangement of ropes with some rigid, say, tubing or sticks or different frames that you may use to keep form. You need to keep the rope, say, different lines. This is called actually long line system, where you have lines of ropes, say, separated 1 meter from each other. You attach the seaweed propagule, the seaweed seed, to the rope. This seed can be a vegetative cutting from another seaweed plant, or it can be spores that you have attached to the rope, and they start growing. You have then you have these rope lines where seaweeds are growing from them, sucking up nutrients from the water and using sunlight for photosynthesis.
And then how do you, you said there's shellfish that can be introduced. How does that work with the seaweed?
Okay, you have different ways to produce shellfish, but then one of them is, say they're called socks or even lanterns. They are hanging structure, very simple structures. Like you make, you put, say a sock is like a net that you fill up with mussels of certain size. You hang them in the water, hanging, say, from the same seaweed rope, and they stay there filtrating seawater and getting their nutrients, their food, actually, their feed, out of the water by this filtering system they have.
So, and this increases biodiversity in the water?
Definitely. We even have a paper where we measured this. We all know, all of us who work with aquaculture at sea, know that anything you put floating on the sea attracts fish and different forms of biodiversity. It can be crustaceans, mollusks, you know. For some reason, they come. This has not even been clearly explained. For example, there is a lot you can find in the literature about fish aggregating devices. So you just throw something floating on the water and you get fish around it. So when you have seaweed farms, you also have feed for some of these animals as well. So you get a complex trophic chain of animals coming to your farm that may sometimes become a plague. You know, I mean, it may not be the best thing that a lot of herbivore fish are coming to feed on your seaweeds, mm-hmm. for example. So it can become a problem, but it happens. You attract biodiversity, you maintain biodiversity, and at the same time, you enhance fisheries. So once you have these floating structures on water, fish come and fishing is improved. So those herbivore fish that are coming to feed on your seaweeds, you may make some traps and get them for you to eat them.
So, okay, when you're harvesting the seaweed, again, those of us who live on land, what if we don't want to eat seaweed? Is seaweed in our products already that we use?
Oh, a lot. One of the main uses of seaweeds is for the hydrocolloid industry. These hydrocolloids or phycocolloids are some thick, long chain carbohydrates these seaweeds have, presumably to protect themselves from the marine environment. That is why some seaweeds, you touch them, they are like plastic kind of filling. These hydrocolloids, like carrageenan or alginate or agar, they are extracted from seaweeds and they're used in many products that we use every day, like toothpaste, like different forms of meats, hams. You put these carrageenans there. So we don't even realize how many products we consume that contain seaweed products. So that is a major industry in the world, like, for example, maybe even more than 10 million tons of seaweeds are being produced just for the hydrocolloid industry.
And what does that do for the product? I think I read that there's seaweed in ice cream, and I couldn't imagine what seaweed is adding to ice cream. Is it a texturizer? Is it a preservative? What's it doing?
Like a gel that gives it consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Thickening. It's a thickening agent. Say you go some places and get a milkshake and you say, oh, how thick this is. Well, it is not only the ice cream, it's the seaweed product there, giving it consistency. So it's used like to give body to many products, like toothpaste, for example. It keeps form in many ways because of this seaweed hydrocolloid in there.
And how does seaweed compare to, like, nutritionally? Is it better for us than meat or I think something similar that would add that same texture would be made from the hooves of animals. So does seaweed, is it healthier for us than those other products?
Well, they are another product to eat. I have eaten many seaweeds. I've read many papers. I've talked with many colleagues. And they can be used already in different combinations, formulations, recipes. They are good in providing protein, fiber. They are low in fat, but they have very specialized fatty acids, omega 3, 6. They are very high and good in some micronutrients like iron, zinc, iodine, some vitamins. Even there is a debate as to how much seaweeds really contribute B12, the vitamin that is lacking in vegan diets, because it is usually only from animal sources. So there is a debate on whether the B12 precursor found in seaweeds is adequate enough as B12 that people need. So they are very useful. They are not very high in calories. That can be changed. You see, we are working at the stage in which many seaweeds we are using, cultivating, are one or two steps away from their natural origin. We have not advanced that much in breeding and selecting. So there can be a lot of work done in improving them. Just by, say, selection, breeding, traditional breeding. We don't even have to resort to some other genetic engineering tools. So there can be a lot of improvements, like increasing their edibility in terms of this high amount of fiber they have, because largely this is due to these hydrocolloids that are not very digestible. So we could, for example, decrease that concentration of hydrocolloids and have more digestible carbohydrates. So this kind of work will take us to having different kind of seaweeds that we already know, for example, but they are more nutritious, more palatable. I joke like saying that eventually we will have seaweeds tasting like bananas. Yeah, you see, we can do a lot of things, and it's being done. Like in China, Japan, they have these very specialized seaweed varieties that they have been developing for centuries. So they're very choosy in what seaweed they want, how they want it. So it's already very much adapted to what they want. The seaweed provides what they want. We need to advance more into that.
Okay, so the seasteading book was published about 2 years ago. So what progress have you seen, and how have your projects grown in those past 2 years?
Well, there has been an increased awareness of the relevance of seaweeds as food, of seaweed cultivation. But this is also due to the fact that we have gone deeper into climate change problems. Water is more limiting, droughts are affecting here and there. So we are realizing more that we need solutions, alternative solutions. So that also has helped, and there are now many countries that are at least at the pilot stage, a demonstration stage, cultivating seaweeds, beginning to cultivate seaweeds, and we have joined efforts with other colleagues from around the world, and we are very clear on about where this is happening, how we should help them advance, how we should or could help other countries realize the relevance of this and begin doing their own pilot experiments and trying to use that as food. So there has been an increase in the awareness and in the global movement towards cultivating seaweeds for different products and ecosystem services, and also in eating seaweeds. They are more available everywhere now.
And when you go to a new country, what are some of the obstacles for people to be able to start building these farms? Are there regulatory barriers, or are there cultural barriers where people need to understand why it will be helpful for them? What are some of the challenges that you have to overcome?
Well, if this were like an exam question, I would say all of the above that you just mentioned. Yes, regulatory laws on aquaculture have not been like drafted or enacted with this in mind, because it's so new. Many countries have not considered it, but there are usually, say, ways of doing this at least initially, experimentally, in a pilot manner. That has not stopped, for example, seaweeds from growing in many places so far.
So how do you go about that? If someone does someone in another country contact you and say, I want to grow one of your farms, and then you go to them and work through the local restrictions, or how do you approach that and look for places where to expand your seaweed farming?
Yes, we have contacts, usually university people that are into this, and they're usually associated with some NGOs and also with some private companies. For example, in India, right now there is a growing interest in India to advance in seaweed cultivation and use as food and for other purposes. And there are already several, say, small to medium-sized companies producing seaweeds for the hydrocolloid market. So even though there is no clear regulatory frame for this, it is allowed. And of course, if we or they want to go like in a much larger effort, I'm sure there would have to be some adjustments to limitations in regulatory processes and permits, concessions. But so far, they are doing it and in a legal manner. And this has happened everywhere. I mean, the laws are usually flexible enough to allow it, even though they have not been enacted with this in mind. So I think this can grow fast enough, unimpeded enough, so that at the same time there are changes happening that allow it to continue grow expansion.
So if I wanted to build a seastead out in the high seas, not in any country's territorial area, then at least that would remove the barrier of these regulations. But what would be the challenge for me to build a seaweed farm out in the high seas? Why aren't people doing that right now?
Well, you see, this is like a stage in where we are not completely experienced in doing this. The markets are not there. Let me give you an example. This hydrocolloid industry was operating in Canada and in other places, and they moved to tropical conditions. And they found that very large farms were inefficient because of nutrient and other limitations. So they went into promoting multiple small farms managed by fishers. And in Indonesia, seaweed farming went from almost nothing to about 7-8 million tons per year in about a 10-12 year period. So, but this is composed mostly of small farms because they take advantage of cheap labor, low cost, startup costs. Like, for example, imagine that you, for any operation you have at in the high seas or just a few miles away from the coast, you need a lot of additional infrastructure, like for taking care of what you have, because you may have everything stolen from you, all the ropes, the buoys. You need boats to go back and forth, harvesting machines, and you see it becomes something that requires a bigger investment, and markets are not there yet. So we have been confronted with a dilemma that I place it like this. There are no seaweeds in markets because there is no production, and there is no production because there is no market. So how do we break this like vicious cycle? We work both ways, say increasing supply, but also trying to increase demand.
How can seasteaders, who I hope are listening to this podcast, how can they find your seaweed and buy it and increase demand?
Yes. Well, there are, for example, in the United States, several companies that are already producing seaweed. They sell it raw, they sell it dry, they sell it in beer, they sell it in cookies.
In beer? They sell it in beer?
Yes. Some people are making seaweed beer. So, you know, what do you call, some people are like call seaweed soap, but it may have like a very small percentage of seaweed. We need to be more clear about that, because not anything that has like, say, 0.5% seaweed becomes a seaweed tortilla chip. So, yeah, but we have made those, and so they're coming. They're coming into the market, and then in Europe, at least in many supermarkets, you find sections with different seaweed products already being sold, and you can choose among them. In the United States, also, you're having some places where you can buy them, and say Amazon or stuff like that. You may start looking around, and you will find more seaweed. It would be great if people would start trying them. People are surprised how interesting flavor, texture they add to your regular meal. For example, we make a bread that has, we substitute wheat flour with, we add 5% seaweed flour, so a 95% wheat flour. And so we get a bread that is like greenish with little specks of seaweed. It gives it like a very interesting flavor. And it is nutritionally better because you have a different complement of amino acids, more iron, more zinc, and the proteins are okay. So you add more fiber. So you can start playing in your kitchen also, not only trying things that are already made with seaweed or have a little seaweed. You can also, for example, have a salt shakers with ground seaweed or in little pieces, and you add it here and there. You're preparing a dish instead of adding only, say, ground black pepper or chili pepper. You may also add a little seaweed here and there. You're making a juice, a fruit juice. You add a little of seaweed and it gets blended together with the fruit. And so you improve your nutrition in many ways. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the major advances that we were able to appreciate in a recent symposium in Korea, the International Seaweed Symposium was conducted, say, like a month and a half ago in Korea, was that they are finding very interesting links with gut microflora, with your microbes, your internal microbes, mm-hmm. and seaweeds. For example, they are exploring this relationship in Japanese communities that have for a long time eaten seaweed and their lower propensity to cancer and longer longevity. And they are associated to eating the seaweeds because they provide, say, this fiber and these bioactive compounds that are turning out to be like very good for you. There are some that are not that great also. It's not like you eat any seaweed and any everything. No, there is work behind that. There is selection. There is, you know, a very serious set of standards that are being formalized, biosecurity issues, inocuity, all these things are related also to seaweed consumption and processing. So it is becoming like yet another set of food that can be used regularly and found everywhere for your use as food.
It sounds like the seaweed market is there's a lot of opportunity with a lot of the other trends in nutrition and climate concerns. So it seems like you would have an optimistic view of building more and more seaweed farms and having that market grow.
Oh, yes. Yes. As I said, we need to work with supply and demand. You know, we cannot say entice many farmers, many fishers, hey guys, let's go and plant seaweed, cultivate seaweed, and then you harvest it and you dry it, you sun dry it, or you have this little drying facility, and then you put it in sacks and nobody's gonna buy it. You know, so it is a situation that it's very well, you have to be very careful in how and when you entice people to grow seaweeds, that you have to assure that there will be somebody buying them these seaweeds at a decent price. And then these people who buy the seaweed also have to have a market for their products. That's why the hydrocolloid industry has promoted seaweed farming with so much success in many countries, like Indonesia, Philippines, and now in India, Sri Lanka, other places they are producing seaweed. Even Chile produces a lot of seaweed for the hydrocolloid market. And because that's a secure market. Mm-hmm. It has had lots of ups and downs. And then there are some seaweeds preferred over other seaweed species. But then that's like in agriculture as well. So that's why the hydrocolloid industry has been key in promoting seaweed cultivation and use. But it's sort of limited. We want to have more. But then for that, we need a market. Sure. And to have a market, we need products.
Yeah. Sure. So what progress do you hope to see in the seasteading movement in the next few years? And you know, how can that align with the growth in seaweed, in the seaweed market?
Yeah, okay. I think that there are two things we're talking about here. If you have a seasteading, you may want to have some levels of food security that you are not strictly required or depend on the boat to come with the food, for example. It may be okay. You may do that. You may depend, rely completely on food from land. But if you're able to produce your own, say like have gardens or begin exploring further and add shellfish and fish cages with fish being fed some of the seaweed you produce, that gives you something to do. Also gives you some additional food, maybe some additional income. Then you may start growing that. If it goes okay, you may find that the area where you have your seastead is adequate for this or that production. And so you may emphasize that and have a bigger production that may come to feed markets in the nearby countries. So it is like a virtuous cycle that you begin testing and adding your own seaweed and the fish, I mean, shellfish, shrimp, lobster. You use some residues from your kitchen, from maybe your waste waters. You may use that after the processing for fertilizing waters to grow more seaweeds. So it can be done. And once you have added levels of security, food security, I think it gives you a more reliable way to be out there, not having to fully, completely depend on food that comes from land.
Sure. Well, I think that's definitely the goal. And it, of course, reduces the cost of living out there because we want people to be able to live out there who, at all levels of income. And you know, in the book, Joe Quirk talks a lot about how your seaweed farms enrich the poor and provide, and we talked a little bit about how it provides a diverse economy for fishing communities. So, you know, I think that having people provide for themselves is a way to have a flourishing community. I think that's maybe the definition of a flourishing community. And I think it's great to have you on our relaunch of the podcast to help seasteaders understand how to get to those free communities on the sea that will be food secure and restore the environment and provide good work for people at all income levels. So as we wrap up our conversation, is there anything else you would like to talk about specifically? Anything else you would like to promote?
Well, I would say go ahead and try them. You know, it is even if you are at the coast or you see some seaweeds, usually you can have some identification, you know, you can see what they are. And you may try those. I mean, you can see, you can talk to locals and harvest a little, try seaweeds, buy them in your supermarket or online and begin playing with that. And you will see that, you know, it helps in many ways. For example, the fiber has many good properties. It is much better than other land sources of fiber. So experiment, and that will help the industry. It will help the movement, and it will help getting into the sea, colonizing the sea, and at the same time taking care of it. So it's a good thing.
Wonderful. And how can people find you? Do you have a website? Do you have social media where people can find you and support you?
You know, I make that mistake because I don't even have business cards. Well, you can find some publications and ResearchGate. You just have to write my name and in Google and it comes up. So you can find me. That my email is usually somewhere in there. So you can find me just by doing that, just by googling me up. Sorry, my English is.
And can people purchase? I think the seasteading book says that you needed 5 people and some minimal investment in this, the ropes and the other pieces for the seastead farm. Is that something that people can find and purchase, or do you have to go through a specific program to get those?
You can do it on your own. There are many ways. Just start searching in images and papers that describe how this farming is done. If you live by the coast, you can have your little patch. But remember, there are some limitations that you have to take care of. For example, you cannot place these where people are boating or where people usually fish with nets. Sometimes they may steal your stuff, you know, away, or just damage it just to see what you have. So it has some conditions that you have to be careful with. And if you have a place that you can do this, go ahead and just put some ropes out and follow some basic designs that you can see in the literature, in the media, and start attaching some pieces of seaweed to your ropes and see how they grow. It is not that complex. There are usually the universities, local state universities, public universities in the United States. They have usually people that are experts in this. Several have some growing seaweed cultivation programs. So you can ask them for help. You can see their websites and get some local information for your own seaweed startup.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. This has been Dr. Ricardo Radulovich on the Seasteading Today podcast. And thanks for being here.
Thank you, Carly. Good luck with the seasteading.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
The Seasteading Today podcast is produced by John Bush. Your host is Carly Jackson. Send feedback and questions to podcast@seasteading.org. To support the podcast and the Seasteading mission, go to seasteading.org/donate. If you'd like to learn more, read the book, Seasteading: How Floating Nations Will Restore the Environment, Enrich the Poor, Cure the Sick, and Liberate Humanity from Politicians. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed, and we'll save you a spot on a seastead.